I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Three Palestinian men have been arrested in connection with a roadside bomb which yesterday killed three Americans in Gaza. Those arrested are reported to be part of a group called the Popular Resistance Committee, an extremist splinter of Yasser Arafat's mainstream Fatah movement. We will hear the latest on this story in just a moment. We want to do something else with this hour, though. We report so often on the Arab-Israeli conflict, but we rarely get a chance to meet the people who live there and hear their perspectives. We plan to do that over the next weeks. Today, we've invited a couple of Israeli settlers in to talk about their lives. And Connection listeners, we'd like you in on that conversation. The settlements are enormously controversial. Many people say that the people who live there are the one reason why this current conflict remains so acrimonious. The settlers and their many supporters say they have a right to establish these communal beachheads in the occupied territories. They say that they are laying claim to safety and to land that they have a right to possess. Well, Connection listeners, what do you think? How do you see the place of the settlers in Israel today? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Before we turn to that part of the hour, though, a chance to catch up on the latest news concerning the Americans killed in Gaza yesterday. The BBC correspondent Barbara Platt is joining us from Jerusalem. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
Does anybody know yet if the American diplomatic convoy that was targeted because it was American?
That's generally the assumption. There's been no official claim yet so far, so we can't say for sure, but that's certainly the way the Israelis are treating it and also the way the Palestinian Authority is treating it. And given the fact that it was a roadside bomb that appears to have been detonated by remote control, so seemingly timed, given the fact that the American convoys are quite obvious, they travel regularly on this road, they couldn't be mixed up with anything else. And given the fact that there's a lot of anti-American sentiment within the Palestinian territories now, that certainly is the way it's being treated.
There were reports of some celebrating in nearby Palestinian refugee camps after news of the deaths. Is that true?
There were some demonstrations, certainly at the site. Rocks were thrown at investigators, American investigators who came. There were reports of celebrations. I don't know how extensive they might have been, but certainly there is very strong anti-American feeling in Gaza in particular, and also to some degree in the West Bank. There was a poll taken, or at least published, I should say, yesterday, which said that 97% of Palestinians believe that American policy is biased in favor of Israel, and 96% believe that the Americans are not sincere in their claim to establish a Palestinian state. And I think those feelings are exacerbated by feelings about military operations that are going on in places like Rafah. This is a town at the edge, the southern edge of the Gaza Strip. It's an Israeli military operation to destroy tunnels that are used for weapon smuggling, but the civilians have suffered a lot. More than 1,200 people have been rendered homeless, and the Americans have defended that as is Israel's right to self-defense. And so that goes over very badly in Gaza and in the West Bank.
So are people in the occupied territory saying that there will be more attacks on Americans because Americans are seen as the military big brother to Ariel Sharon's government?
No, they're not, actually. In fact, it's very interesting that none of the militant groups has claimed the attack, and all of them have been very quick to deny any association with them. During the past 3 years, there haven't been any deadly attacks against American targets, and the militant groups have said and made a point of saying that their quarrel is with Israel because Israel is occupying their territory and they don't want to expand that quarrel. And militant leaders came out and said the same thing yesterday. They all denied any association with it. There were some people, civilians who, as we've discussed, felt glad to see what they would consider an enemy targeted, but many more also were quite worried because they felt that if this attack, whoever carried it out, would bring the American wrath down on their heads, and also the Americans being the only ones that, in their view, who might be able to help broker a peace agreement at some stage, this would be very, very bad for the Palestinians.
Last point, Barbara, do we make anything of the fact that it was Palestinian policemen who arrested these suspected bombers? Because it seems at one level to put the lie to the Palestinian claim that they can't do anything to control the violence in the camps and in the territories.
Yes, there's a couple of issues here. The Americans and the Israelis argue that there are about 20,000 armed, uniformed men on the ground that the Palestinian Authority has, most of them in Gaza, because that's where the infrastructure is the least damaged. And they say, look, you've got the men on the ground, so why don't you send them after the militant groups? The Palestinian Authority would argue it's not just an issue of technical capacity, it's an issue of political legitimacy. We don't have the legitimacy to go after the main opposition movements because the occupation continues, the Israelis are assassinated, assassinating the leaders of militant groups. They're entering camps like Rafah and destroying houses. Under these circumstances, we can't go after the militant groups because then we look like collaborators. Now, as I said, all of the main opposition or militant groups denied that they had any association with this attack. So it probably would be easier for the Palestinian Authority to go after certain individuals or maybe a splinter group, if that's indeed somebody who carried it out, than it would be to confront the main opposition groups directly.
Barbara, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
BBC correspondent Barbara Plett speaking to us from Jerusalem. Now, as I mentioned earlier in the program, Connection listeners, this hour we want to widen the conversation about the Arab-Israeli conflict. We've asked two settlers to join us. These are the people who have chosen a life in settlements built on disputed land. These are the Israelis closest to the conflict. And we'll introduce now David Halevi. He grew up in Albany, New York, but exactly a year ago moved to Israel, a small community with seven families near Jericho in the Jordan Valley. Hello, David. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Nice to have you here. And Rachel Avital lives in Ofra, and she's lived there for the past 18 years, has raised five children in a community which is one of the first settlements in the West Bank, now consists of some 2,000 residents, and she's with David in a studio in Jerusalem. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Hi.
I want to ask you about your decision just to move to a settlement, because I guess it was sometime in the mid-'80s you made a shift from a home on a kibbutz to a settlement. Why did you decide to make that change?
Well, there were a number of reasons. I won't go into why we decided to leave the kibbutz. We just felt that that type of life wasn't suited to us anymore on the economic, sociological level. But community-wise, we liked that type of small rural community, close-knit. And we were looking for a similar type of community, and we found it in Ofra, where there are a lot of other ex-kibbutznikim living. We're very happy with our choice.
Tell me what it's been like for you over the past 3 years, how your life has changed.
Well, it's been very difficult for everyone in Israel in the past 3 years. And I wouldn't say that our lives in Ofra have changed. Essentially, it's more a question of quantity rather than essence. In other words, there were dangers before the past 3 years as well. It's just that they have become far more intense in the past 3 years, and we're sharing those dangers with many more people, unfortunately, all over Israel. It's not only the people in the settlements now, because before this war broke out, there were drive-by shootings and other attacks on the settlements, not as intense, of course, as they have been in the past 3 years. But now there are attacks all over Israel and Israel's cities as well.
Mm-hmm. I understand, Rachel, that no one in your immediate family has been hurt in the attacks, but people who you know quite well have been affected.
Yes, that's very true. In our community of Ofra, we've lost quite a number of people. A neighbor just across the street was shot and killed on his way home from work. Just a few months later, his son was shot and killed in almost identical circumstances on his way to work. Just about a year ago, a woman who happens to sit just behind me, used to sit behind me in the synagogue, was killed in Jerusalem at the bus stop together with her five-year-old granddaughter and five other people. They were blown up by a suicide bomber. And there have been others. We've lost quite a number of people in the past few years, and it's been quite horrendous in that respect.
And David Halevi, you're sitting in Albany, New York, contemplating a move to Israel, listening to the news reports of what Rachel is just describing. And I'm wondering if there were times when you thought to yourself, whoa, do I really want to move from New York to that type of life?
No, my conviction and desire to move to Israel has been there since sixth grade, and the presence of violence here would only strengthen that to a certain degree, in that if you feel an attachment to a certain place, if you feel like a certain place and its people is your home, if it becomes under attack, you don't run away from your home. You want to go to your home and you want to be there in a supportive manner. It's much worse hearing the news as a Jew who feels a strong connection to the Jewish people from America than it is here.
Did you have people in Albany saying, maybe you shouldn't go just now? Maybe you should wait till things are a little quieter?
No, by and large, the community was very supportive and happy with the move.
Tell me about your new home, David. You're in one of the newer settlements, so I guess you're living in a trailer or a mobile home. Is that right?
That's correct.
How many people are there in the settlement?
There's about 20 people there right now. and it's been there for 4 years. It was started by several Israelis along with several immigrants from France who came to the area in order to attend and help renovate the most ancient synagogue in the world, which is at the very outskirts of Jericho. And they started going there to attend the synagogue and to help fix it up and to hopefully establish a Jewish community nearby, which they succeeded in doing.
Now, you don't have a family now, but you hope to raise a family and hope to raise it there in Meviot Jericho?
It's a beautiful place.
Is it dangerous?
It's a very relative question. I mean, it's certainly no more dangerous than many other places in Israel, including Jerusalem. In point of fact, we have fairly friendly relations with the one Arab village that's nearby called Uja. And the main difference between living on a settlement and living in a city is that in a settlement, it's generally a homogenous population. So anybody out of place is very easily recognizable. It's not so easy to be wounded, killed by somebody from within your community, whereas in a large city, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Haifa, it can be any number of hundreds of thousands of people. It's the random face. It's in many ways much scarier to walk down Jerusalem than it is to live in a settlement.
Rachel, you've raised 5 kids there. Do you agree with what David's saying?
Well, to a certain extent, that's quite true. We feel very confident and safe in the community. Many people don't even bother to lock their doors during the day. The kids can walk around freely. I'm not a carpool mom. I don't have to take my kids to their, you know, extracurricular activities and to their friends in the afternoon. They ride their bikes around in the community and they feel very, very safe. Walking down the street in Jerusalem, as David has mentioned, or sitting down in a cafe or going to the mall, you have this constant sense of added security everywhere you go. Every public building you enter, you're checked by a security guard. There's more of that pervasive feeling of constant fear of terror attacks than in the communities themselves. The communities themselves, we feel very confident and secure, thank God.
Has the threat of violence, though, strengthened your determination to stay there in any way?
Well, it certainly hasn't weakened my determination in no way, shape, or form. In fact, I'd like to add that this past summer, we've had over 30 families, new families, join Ofra, including about 20 families of new immigrants from France who've come. There are no free houses available anymore in Ofra. We'd have to build new ones in order to be able to absorb new families. There are a lot of people coming to live in the community. People realize it's a wonderful place to live. And we feel very, 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 very strong connection to the place that we live. And we have a very strong commitment. I have 2 married daughters. One lives in Ofra, and the other lives in a community not far from Ofra. We feel very strongly connected.
Connection listeners, no one will ever question the determination of people like Rachel and David to live where they choose to live, but they are enormously controversial homes. And right near the center of the conflict in the region, we'd like to bring you into our conversation with them. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. In this hour, a chance to speak with 2 people who have made a decision to live in the Israeli settlements. David Halevi lives in one that's fairly new. Rachel Avital is living in Ofra, which has been well established for some period of time. And they, more than perhaps most of us, are aware of just how difficult life there can be, and also how controversial it can be. They've agreed to join us on the program to chat with me and to chat with you about their life there. David, let me turn back to you. I understand that the Israeli government sees the Gate of Jericho, the English name of the settlement where you live, as a strategic place that in some way or in the future could provide a buffer between Ramallah and Jericho, 2 large Palestinian cities. Is that accurate?
There are certainly national or strategic interests in a Jewish presence in the Jordan Valley, but the government's motivation in helping to set up Jewish communities there is not necessarily representative, and certainly my case is not representative, my motivation and the reason I want to live there.
You're there as a religious man to be close to that ancient synagogue that you described, right?
Yes.
And so do you feel at all torn by the fact that you're useful as well to the government as a settler in that specific place?
I think that the controversy around settlements is largely artificial in that everybody has, not everybody, but a large number of people have seemingly accepted at face value the idea of a Judean Samaria, of a West Bank that is entirely Judenrein, that is free of Jews. And I think that is very bizarre. If somebody were to advocate for the expulsion of a million Arabs living inside of proper Israel, quote unquote, they would be marked as racist and extremist. But the idea of kicking out Jews simply because they are Jews, because the people living there don't want to have Jews as neighbors, has become an acceptable idea. I think that is rather ironic, to say the least.
Rochelle, how do you explain it to your daughters in terms of who owns the land, who has a right to live where you live?
Well, I've never really had to explain it. We are an observant Jewish family. My daughters study the Bible in school. We read it at home. They hear it in the synagogue. I mean, it's there for anybody who wants to read it. Anybody can see who the land belongs to and who God gave the land to. I mean, that is not really an issue in our home. And I would imagine in most of the homes, although I would like to point out that not all the settlers are Orthodox Jews. Mm-hmm. There are more. I'm pretty sure at least half of the people living in Judea and Samaria are not Orthodox Jews, just regular Israelis, traditional, secular, whatever. You know, I wouldn't say that this is an entirely a religious issue per se, other than the fact, unless you consider the fact of one's national identity to be a religious issue.
But does that mean that in the future, when your grandchildren set up homes nearby, that there will be room there for Palestinians, for Arabs? Or are you saying that this is Jewish land and it is only for the Jews?
If I could please answer that, actually.
Yeah, I'd like to hear from both of you, because it cuts sort of to the center of where we are with this.
I saw a very interesting picture of Ofra from about 20 years ago. And the picture is of this Jewish community, Ofra, with about, I'd say, about 300 homes at the time, several large buildings, including a large synagogue. And in the background, you see about three caravans. And they're not Jewish caravans. They're Arab. And that's it. There's three families, three Arab families, living across the road about a mile away.
Much less than a mile.
Today, that Arab village, I assume, has a population in the upwards of 50,000, 40,000 people easily, whereas Ofra has been hard-pressed to be allowed to grow freely. The idea that Jewish settlement encroaches on Arabs or prevents the Arab population from being able to grow freely is nonsense.
I'd like to point out that the Jewish settlements, what you call settlements, I'd like to call them Jewish communities, in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza only represent a little over 1% of the land. The Palestinians have the other 98-point-something% of the land and live in it freely and have had full control of it for the last 10 years. I think that's a very important point. There's a huge misapprehension of the situation. There has been Palestinian autonomy. Over 98% of the Palestinian population and almost very close to about, say, 85% of the land for the past 9 to 10 years.
I mean, I find it curious, just one last point, that simply the name of the place or the location of the place makes it okay for the idea that a Jewish presence prevents others from living there. I mean, if we were to say, the fact that there are many Jews living in New York City prevents whatever other population you like from living there freely. That would be an entirely unacceptable idea.
Is that really a useful parallel? I mean,
I think it is. I don't understand why my presence
when people look at
somebody else from living there.
At the controversy from a North American perspective, and Rachel, you're from Canada, David, most recently from the United States, you know how the issue is seen in this country and the way it is regarded by the U.S. government and European governments is, hey, wait a second, that land has been in dispute since 1973. And as a result, whoever lives there is something that is a political statement. It's not like moving from one city block to another in New York City.
Well, I'm very happy that you used the word in dispute, because that is indeed the correct term, not occupied territory, but rather territory that is in dispute. And as far as Israel's legal right, or the legal right of Jews to settle in the areas of Judea, Samaria, and Gaza, it is certainly equal to the right of Americans to settle in, or I'd say even greater than, a large part of the southwestern part of the United States. If you consider that land that was won in a war of defense, there are many countries that have land that they won in a war of defense. They have not been forced to give that land back. They have completely annexed it and made it part of their own territory. That's a norm in international law. And in fact, if we're going to go back in history, the areas of the entire area west of the Jordan River, what's known as the West Bank, which is kind of a funny kind of name because it's a very, very small river with a huge bank. But the entire part of Western Eretz Israel, what's known as, was allocated for the Jewish people. The fact that Israel's borders didn't extend all the way to the Jordan River was an anomaly of war, of the 1948 war, that its supply lines were too short and so on and so forth, and it ended there. But illegally, Israel Jews have just as much right to settle in Judea and Samaria. I think it's very important to point out something which to us is entirely obvious, and to anyone who's conversant with the subject. There never has been a Palestinian state in history. There never was a Palestinian nation that had a piece of land or had a state to call its own. It's been made to seem as if Israel has destroyed something that once existed, and now they want it back. That's not the situation at all. There never was a Palestinian state. And in fact, in all the time until 1967, in the Six-Day War, when Israel won that land, as I said, in a war of defense, the people that lived there could have made a state if they so wanted. But nobody even mentioned the word Palestinian state.
Rachel, it's a semantic argument, though, isn't the difference
between... It's not at all semantic.
No, hang on a sec. Just the difference between the use of the word state and the use of the word land is where that your part of the argument turns, though.
Well, no, not at all. Because when you say state or nation, first of all, the Palestinian nation, what is known as the Palestinian nation, is no different ethnically, culturally, linguistically from any of the other Arab nations. There is a majority of Palestinians in Jordan. About around 80% of Jordanian citizens are Palestinians. Does that make it a Palestinian state? Perhaps it does. If they're the majority in that state, perhaps that's a Palestinian state as well. The fact that when you have a country, that means you have the right to an army, you have a right to borders, you have a right to foreign relations, you have a right to make military treaties with other countries. Those are very important issues for Israel.
Those are things
that would endanger the existence of the state of Israel.
I want to try and get some of our callers in here because we have a number of people who've been waiting. Let's go first to Carborough, North Carolina, and Matthew's joining us. Hi, Matthew.
Hi there. I'm barely able to control myself. I'm a religious Jew. I have family in Israel. My family escaped persecution in Eastern Europe, and I'm absolutely totally offended at what these people are saying. I don't want to argue about the absurd history and lies that they're telling, but that's fine. Let's talk about the facts on the ground right now. Settlements result in roads being built to cut through Palestinian territory where innocent Palestinians have their orchards tore up. They have innocent Palestinians have their houses demolished. There's endless numbers of roadblocks. The thought that the
Matthew,
the,
are you telling Rachel and David that they have no right to live where they live?
No, I'm not telling them that at all. What I'm saying is this. We need to recognize that the construction of these settlements creates difficulties and have been creating difficulties since well before the Second Intifada for the Palestinians living there, creating an environment where Palestinians feel like their land is being taken away and see these beautiful, gorgeous settlements built with American money, filled with Americans who are moving there or Russians who are moving there, and they themselves have their society getting choked more and more. Now, even if I am only 50% right in this, your two guests deny it. They lie about it, and they can't recognize that something must be done so that there isn't such a horrible disparity between the two communities. So one community doesn't feel itself getting choked, and the other community doesn't appear to be lording it over
Matthew,
them.
Let's
That's
hear,
the only road towards peace.
Let's hear from David on this. David, as I said earlier in the program, you were watching and listening to news in the United States just a year ago, and you've been living life outside Jericho for the past year. So much of what Matthew is saying, you know, is the way that people in this country are trying to puzzle out the settlement situation. What about his assertion that as long as some settlements remain there, they are a provocation? They are one of the reasons why suicide bombers use suicide bombs.
Well, first of all, I think it's interesting that Orthodox Jew from North Carolina refers to Jews that choose to move to Israel as Americans, Russians, and other nationalities, but not as other Jews. I find that interesting. But to answer your question more directly, for one, I'd be curious how he knows his information and how he is sure that it's accurate, meaning that the settlers, ironic as it is, are one of the few Jewish populations, let alone populations of the world, that actually interacts with the Palestinians. The lovely settlements that are built on American money, as he claims, well, interestingly enough, our settlement was actually aided by Arab villagers. They helped us build it. They've helped us set up orchards. They've helped us pave the road.
Okay, but
they've
let's,
helped
let's
us
try
build
and get,
buildings there.
Get to the number of it. I'm not gonna, I mean, I know that there'll be an example that Matthew would use to say, well, look at the settlement in Gaza. There is no love there. And,
okay, but then to...
I do want to,
fine,
though,
but
try and
to
move
to
the
that more directly,
provocative
to that,
part of it here.
To address that more directly, I think that I totally do not accept the political arguments that you implied earlier and that he stated, meaning that the presence of a Jewish community as a... any political issue around that is a face. It's a mask for something else. That somebody can say with a straight face that the presence of such and such a kind of person, a Jew, a black, a Latino, whatever it is, has a moral equivalency and justifies the murder of people, justifies even the anger that would cause somebody to murder, is dehumanizing. And interestingly enough, Professor Rashid Khalidi, who I learned with a little bit at the University of Chicago, where I received my BA, who is one of the leading Palestinian academics, himself does not accept the said argument and says that when Palestinians and Arabs at large are denied their freedom of choice and denied their ability to make moral human choices and instead are treated as animals who automatically react to this, ah, you stole my land, oh, I'll kill you. He says that that is actually an incredibly racist and demeaning view of the Arab population in the Muslim world.
Rochelle?
If I might add, I mean, I've lived in Ofra for about 18 years. Mm. I'd like to tell you what it was like 18 years ago when I first moved to Ofra. There were no bypass roads, the roads that the gentleman mentioned. We used to drive through Ramallah and El Bira. I used to do my shopping there. My next-door neighbor took her driving lessons there. We used to take our cars in to be fixed. We had a very pleasant coexistence with the Arab population there and in the village next to us. My brother-in-law had his kitchen built by a carpenter from the village. I had my refrigerator fixed by a technician from Allah, and so on and so forth. The problems began, ironically enough, when peace broke out in 1993, after the Oslo Accords were signed. That is when the bypass roads were built. And I'd like to refresh Matthew's unfortunately poor memory. Until 3 years ago, until this war broke out, there were no roadblocks. There were about at least 50,000 Palestinians coming into Israel every single day to work. I might have my numbers wrong. I think it's even more than 50,000.
Well, I was working in Israel more than 3 years ago and found myself going through roadblocks to go into places like Bethlehem, to go into places like
Ramallah. There were very few roadblocks.
They were there. Let's be fair.
Yes, of course, because there were problems.
All right.
But until this war, this horrible war that has targeted civilians, children, babies, and throwing rocks also, I might add, is also quite lethal, and I don't want to get into examples, but there are plenty of them, of people being severely injured and even killed just by rocks.
Rachel, let me stop you if I can,
yes,
because we're at risk of not getting some of our callers in. Let's go next to Savannah, Georgia. Kyle's joining us. Hi, Kyle.
Hi. First of all, thank you for taking my call, and I want to thank your guests for being on the show. I'm an Arab-American, and I served in the military, and I had the pleasure of being in Israel a couple of times. And the whole issue between the Israelis and the Arabs, it's close to my heart more because I'm of the Hashemite tribe
from
of Jordan.
Yeah.
And if you probably know this already, my family has suffered a lot to broker peace between the Arabs and the Israelis for years and years and years. My question and comment is this: do you think, as Jewish settlers or Israeli citizens, that perhaps there could be a reconciliation between you and the Palestinians, where forget the governments, because politicians, they never agree as far as I'm concerned, but as far as people, just you and the population of the Arabs who are living there, do you think there could be peace between you and them, and maybe just go back to the way it used to be in the 20s and even before that, where Jews and Arabs just lived and worked together and were friends? The other comment that I have, just as you're saying before, what happens to Israel as far as terrorism, it is unacceptable from the religious point of view, being a Muslim, killing an innocent people, that is wrong. That's not what the religion, or even as being an Arab, stands for. However, we cannot also deny that there have been some zealots in the Israeli army, in the IDF, which I've seen myself, people like the 12-year-old little boy that was caught in a crossfire with his dad a couple of years ago.
Kyle, I have to stop you because we're coming up to a break, but I'm going to take your first question and put it to my guests. We'll hear from them when we come back after the break. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Question, connection listeners: can Palestinians and Israelis live together? Is there any going back to what people describe as better days in the past? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My two guests this hour, Rachel Avital, lives in Ofra in the West Bank, has lived there for 18 years and raised 5 children there. David Halevi has just recently moved to Mevo'ot Jericho. That's the Gate of Jericho. It's a relatively new Israeli settlement between Jericho and Ramallah. He's from Albany, New York. They've agreed to join us to talk about the circumstances and the situation as they see it from their perspective. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And Rachel, maybe I can ask you to speak to Kyle's point, his notion, I guess, that if there was some way of depoliticizing the conflict, that there would be a better opportunity for Palestinians and Israelis to live well together. Does he have anything there that resonates with you?
Well, it definitely resonates very strongly. As I mentioned earlier, we had a very pleasant coexistence with our neighbors in the past, and I look back with great nostalgia to that. Unfortunately, I'm not very hopeful, because when I see what has been done to the education of the children in the Palestinian Authority, how the children there have been brainwashed, I don't know if you've seen any of these video clips. I've seen them. They're horrifying. Seeing 4-year-old little girls dressing up with Kalashnikov rifles, saying that their greatest desire is to be a shaheed and blow themselves up and kill some Jews. It's really horrifying and very, very depressing to think how the minds of these children have been twisted. It's very hard to be hopeful under circumstances like that. I don't know how many years it will take for these children to be deprogrammed There's so much hatred that these children and Holocaust denial and denial of the right of Israel to exist as a people, denial of Jewish history. Arafat himself has said that the temple never stood on the Temple Mount, and so on and so forth.
But there's politics on both sides here. I mean, there are provocative statements being made
on both sides here. While the children of the Palestinian Authority were being brainwashed to despise anything Jewish and Israeli, Jewish children in our schools were being taught the importance of peace and peaceful relations. And when there have been isolated cases of extremists, for example, what comes to mind immediately is the case of Dr. Goldstein in Hebron, who killed close to 30 Palestinians. Those cases were repudiated across the board by all Israelis from all colors and all political beliefs. Those are exceptions. If there is any brutality in the army, and I'm sure there is under some cases, many of the soldiers there are terribly frightened as well, but cases of brutality are treated very harshly by the Israeli courts.
David, this is not
something that is condoned in Israel.
Sure. His statement and question speaks to me as well. It troubles me greatly to see the conditions under which the Arabs in Israel have to live at times, though my guilt is obviously extremely limited in that it is largely, unfortunately, sadly, tragically, the fault of their own people, their own leaders, and the greater Arab world. And just to give an example, I was driving home last night, and it's a very quiet road. It snakes down the Judean desert. And on the side of the road, I saw an Arab, his car had broken down. He was signaling for somebody to stop to help him, and there's a good chance there would not be much traffic after I passed. Now, I very much wanted to stop for him. I felt bad that he was stuck in the middle of nowhere and was likely to be stuck there for several hours. I genuinely felt bad that I could not stop and help him because I was afraid that perhaps he's tricking me and he's going to try and kill me. Now, it might be that statistically, I don't know, that would be the more unlikely situation. But, you know, a handful of people that are willing to do anything to kill Jews amongst a civilian population makes it very hard. You know, it makes it very hard because you never know who's the one who wants to kill you and who's the one who's just a schmo, who's a Joe, who lives next door, who's a friendly guy. You can't tell the difference, and you're not going to risk it when your life is always on the line.
Our number's
1-800. I can tell you personal stories of my own, of my car breaking down and Arabs stopping and helping. And on the other hand, when I went to the hospital to give birth in an ambulance with the lights flashing, being stoned, as we drove by an Arab village. So it works both ways.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Exeter, New Hampshire, Steve is joining us. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I've been listening very carefully to their justification for claiming West Bank land for settlements. And as far as I can tell, it comes down to this, that going back thousands of years, people who practiced Judaism lived on that land or around it, and they practice Judaism today, and therefore they have more right to that land than somebody else who isn't Jewish. And in fact, the lady you have as a guest said explicitly that God gave people who practice Judaism that land.
Have you got a question specifically for Rachel, Steve?
Is that the only? Yeah, of course. In fact, that's the question. How is it that the justification is any more than that?
I'm sorry, I don't quite understand the question. Is gentleman referring to specifically to the lands of Judea and Samaria? Because the Bible didn't exactly tell us that we are promised the lands of Judea, Samaria, and not the area around Tel Aviv or Haifa or any of those areas. When I say that God gave the land to the Jews, I'm referring to all of the land of Israel. Not just to where Ophrah happens to be located. So any justification, any biblical justification for the Jews to return to the place which they were forced out of 2,000 years ago applies equally to Ophrah and to Mevaot Yericho, where David lives, as well as to Tel Aviv, Haifa, or Eilat.
I'd also like to jump in here. Two points. One is one that I've tried to make several times, but Perhaps I'm not being clear enough. I do not feel the need to justify my right to exist and my right to exist as a Jew who lives in the land of Israel. And I do not think that my right to do so prohibits anybody else from doing so. To the extent that the Jewish presence in Judea and Samaria has had a negative impact on the Arab population, that has little to do, in fact, with the Jewish presence in Judea and Samaria. It has much to do with the violence that's been perpetuated. The violence has not been limited to settlements and to the West Bank.
Are you saying,
so-called,
David, that you're
It's been discotheques in Tel Aviv. It's been in places in Haifa. It's deliberately targeted left-leaning institutions like the Moment Cafe, where you had, you know, and the Hillel Cafe in the German colony.
Okay, but David,
are both known as institutions whose clientele specifically support more quote-unquote left-wing
solutions. You're saying that you have a right to be where you are, but are you also saying that your exercise of that right has no consequences in that country?
I do not feel that somebody else who's perpetuating violence against a people, that there is any kind of moral equivalency between...
I'm not making a moral equivalency. That's not the road I'm going down. I'm just saying, as I did earlier, whether or not either of you are acknowledging that by either living in or developing new settlements, as the government says it wants to do, whether or not you see that as provocative.
No. Daniel Pipes said recently that he thinks that peace could be established between the Arabs in the area and the state of Israel by the year 2033. And the reason he said this is because he said that the greatest fault of Oslo was that the Jews in Israel believed that the Arabs had accepted a Jewish presence in the Middle East, that they had accepted the right of Jews to live in the Middle East. And he said that wasn't in fact true.
All right, let's see if
everybody
we can squeak
Everybody who calls in and pushes, like, how do you feel you have the right to live there?
Yeah.
And encourages this kind of attitude that Jews, in fact, don't have the right to live there, are not helping peace. They're not being liberal by doing so. All they are doing is helping to perpetuate the conflict by fanning the flames and the ideas and the rhetoric that, in point of fact, Palestinian violence against the Jewish people can and will result in our expulsion and leaving the land. That is not true. All they promote is hatred.
Let's go to Tingsboro, Massachusetts now. Addie's joining us. Hi, Addie.
Hi. I would like to ask your guests what they would do with the Arabs living in the West Bank. Would they be willing to incorporate them into the State of Israel, or do they want to remove them? How would they deal with that situation, with the reality on the ground?
Rachel.
Okay. Well, we certainly don't want to remove them. I don't think it's possible. I don't think it may not be moral. I think that we have to be a little bit more creative in our solutions. Obviously, we can't incorporate them into the state of Israel because that would make Israel have an Arab majority and it would no longer be a Jewish state because it's a democracy. However, another possibility would be to have them go back to having Jordanian citizenship as they did before 1967. The people living in Judea and Samaria could be linked.
You don't mean Jordanian citizenship. You mean go live in Jordan, right?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I mean to live remain where they live and to have Jordanian citizenship, just as I remain where I live and I have Israeli citizenship. It would be a kind of an unusual situation, but I don't think an impossible one, where we would share. We would live on the same piece of land. We would each have autonomy over our own areas and have citizenship of the country that we belong to. And the areas of Judea and Samaria were, in fact, annexed, and illegally, I might add, by Jordan after 1948. And I see no reason why it can't go back to that situation before.
What do you two think could be done to reduce the level of violence? If there was a limit put on the number of settlements that would be built from this moment forward.
Would that be
something that you would say, yes, you'd agree to? Would you go so far as to say...
I think that would encourage violence, because giving into terror, what was happening... I'd like to just turn the clock back 3 years. 3 years ago, The Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, offered Arafat 97% of the land, shared sovereignty in Jerusalem, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Arafat's response was this war of terrible, terrible violence. Now, in 1947, just very briefly, I'd like to encapsulate.
Oh, we don't have time. We've got like
two or three minutes
left in the program,
okay.
Rachel.
Well, if Arafat wanted peace, he could have had it 3 years ago.
I got
and
you on that.
And his answer is he doesn't want a Palestinian state alongside Israel. He wants a Palestinian state instead of Israel.
What would you to do for peace, though? What would you do if you thought it would lead to a more peaceful life? Not necessarily for you, perhaps for your children or grandchildren.
It's nonsensical to discuss peace in the way that you're trying to frame it, given the current situation. I would be more than happy to open up dialogues or all sorts of programs like that if the situation was different. But when somebody's got a gun to your head, you don't say, hey, listen, let's sit down and talk.
But there's guns,
you defend yourself.
Guns in both hands and guns to both heads.
Again,
you're describing a life.
Again, you're making a moral equivalency between those defending themselves and those murdering.
You know,
there's no moral equivalency.
You're describing a situation where the violence continues till there's one man or one woman left standing.
Wrong. I never said that the Palestinians have to leave. You know, it's just the opposite.
I didn't say that. I'm just saying
that
you're saying that there is no place to talk about peace now.
How many times, you know, every time a new government comes into the PA, it's as if it's like starts from scratch again, like Query, Abbas, whoever comes in, it's as if it's from playing ball, you know, it starts all over again. Okay, let's give us 2 months to see if we can stop the violence. It's as if there's no continuity at all. There's no responsibility. There's no moral weight or accountability on the side of the Palestinians. That's nonsense.
Rachel, will your grandchildren live behind fences then?
I sincerely hope not, and I'm convinced that the only possibility for peace is when the Arabs, the Palestinians, and the rest of the Arabs realize that violence is not going to drive the Jews out of Israel. Only then, when they realize that violence is not the answer, will they be willing, when they're willing to accept our presence here, will it be possible to reach a state of peace?
I want to thank both of you for coming in. You've been very generous with your time. Rachel Avital lives in Ofra. Rachel, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
David Halevi, it was good to have you on the program.
Thanks, I appreciate being here.
David lives in Mivot, Jericho. Forgive my pronunciation. Earlier in the program, we talked with BBC correspondent Barbara Platt in Jerusalem. Connection listeners, we invite you to continue the conversation in the forum section of our website. You can find us at theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.